Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live daily afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Collectors, it's the moment you've been waiting for. You've marked it in your calendar, which is something I haven't done since I didn't know we had the show until this morning. But it's exciting because it's the stamp and coin show today. Numismatics and phlebotomy, I believe.
Phlebotomy. Exactly, yeah.
We welcome back David Tripp. He's the former director of Sotheby's Coin, Tapestry, and Musical Instrument Departments. He's author of Illegal Tender, Gold, Greed, and the Mystery of the Lost 1933 Double Eagle, as well as a fine art consultant, and a fine one at that, and a cartoonist. Also joining us this afternoon, Bob Scott, our stamp expert, director of the Postage Stamp Department, Bonhams, an English-owned international auction house. Previously, Bob spent 2 years as senior technical specialist at Christie's Auction House and was director of Sotheby's Postage Stamp Department for 7 years. David and Bob, welcome back to the show.
Welcome. We love being here.
We do indeed.
Been far too long.
Is it chilly enough for you in the studio?
Oh, it's wonderful. Keeps us awake. We don't want to fall asleep.
We're all on a beach, aren't we?
We are, yes.
In your mind, you're
always
sipping cocktails.
Okay,
yes, definitely.
All right. So the beach is actually out front on the curb. Good.
Yes.
David and Bob are here. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org, or you can hit us on Twitter, at @WAMCVoxPop, or, Facebook.com/WAMCRadio. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Gentlemen, the question that is on everyone's lips, and when I say everyone, I mean Dina Salzman in the front office. When are the new Star Trek stamps coming out?
Bob.
It's very exciting.
Good grief.
Yeah. I mean, this is the kind of important...
Star Trek stamps, that's important stuff.
This is the news that our listeners really need.
Well, I mean, letters have always needed to boldly go where letters have never been before.
So you really have no idea then?
Absolutely none whatsoever.
All right. Well, sorry, Dina. I'll tell you what. The notes you handed me during the news just floored me. I don't know what they mean, but...
that's the whole point.
It says here, Tripp and Scott discover the longest unbroken provenance chain for U.S. mint coins. What on earth does that mean?
Well, we were working on a collection, a fabulous collection, and it had a $1794 dollar in it, which is the first year we made silver dollars in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And there were bits and pieces of its history that were known and unknown, and kind of decided to try and unravel who owned it, when they owned it, and who they were. And through a series of, it was really kismet and serendipity, we managed to trace the history of this particular coin, unbroken ownership, back to 1794.
Wow.
And we identified the man who first purchased it, who was an Englishman who was over here visiting.
Had to be, really, didn't it?
1794. He bought... at face value, brand new coins with a face value of $6.72, including two silver dollars.
Nice.
And what's really fascinating about this guy, Sir William Strickland, as was his name, is that in addition to finding these coins and having left them in his family, while he was visiting America, he met and stayed at Mount Vernon with George Washington.
Wow.
He met and stayed with Thomas Jefferson at Monticello, knew most of the founding fathers, and was a very, very interested man and toured America. And he came straight up this way.
Really?
He came up through Peekskill. He stayed at Claremont with Robert Livingston. He then came through Hudson. Came through Kinderhook, probably went right past the house I live in today.
That's amazing.
Came up, spent 2 weeks in Albany, went across as far north as Saratoga, and then came down and then went through the Berkshires, where Bob lives, and over to Boston, where he met John Adams, and then back to New York.
Wow.
And so we've got this fascinating train based on one coin.
And so you had to do all this, like, you had a triptych, AAA triptych, obviously.
Well, yeah, clearly. Most of it was done, from papers.
That's
incredible.
And
his papers are at the New York Historical Society, and nobody knew who this guy was.
So you are 100% certain that the coin, you can trace it and you know exactly where it is.
We know the house it came out of, and that was the starting point. And then we started doing, it's a little bit of genealogy, it's a little bit of footwork, it's a little bit of, Bob was finding fascinating things that I hadn't seen. And the coin actually sat until 1964, when it was first offered for auction, in a cabinet four coins that was actually commissioned directly from Thomas Chippendale himself, the great Chippendale.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was removed for auction. And so we were able to find all the little families. And of course, it was an English family. So brothers and sisters, in-laws and outlaws were also cousins and second cousins once removed.
Right.
And so it all fit together perfectly.
So does it make it worth more?
I think
when
so.
When you know whence it came?
We sold the coin.
Really?
Yeah.
How much?
$4,993,750.
That's good money.
But that was just one of the coins. That I mean, if you added the total value of all of them, you'd be up to...
Well, we've sold so far from this one collection four of the 30 coins he bought for an aggregate of $6.5 million.
Zikes!
And some of those were half cents and cents. So if you figure out the multiple, he paid a penny, and they were selling for $200,000.
Yikes. So what's your cut?
Nothing.
Nothing?
We get the thrill.
Oh, gosh.
It's the thrill of the chase.
Listen, you need a better agent. This is ridiculous.
You want to sign us up?
No. Well, I'm in public radio. Do you think I have an agent?
It might do.
you could be our agent if you've got nothing better to do.
I don't think I have good business sense. Let's go to Israel in Newburgh. You're on.
Yeah, I had a question for you. Two questions. The Red Book in America, it says a coin is worth X amount.
Right.
And then I want to sell it, and I can't get nearly as much as they claim. What's the reason for that?
The Red Book is basically retail. That's the retail price. That is the price that most dealers would sell you something for. If you want closer to what a dealer will offer, you can, of course, always use the internet, but there is something called the Blue Book, which is more in line with what dealers pay. There's a, you know, dealers have to make a living, and sometimes their profits are egregiously high.
Yeah.
But for the most part, the prices you see in the Red Book are, you know, basically solid retail prices. So if you went into a coin dealer in New York or anywhere in the country, and it says in the Red Book for X grade, it's worth $100, that's pretty much what you're going to pay.
Okay.
That doesn't mean in the Blue Book they might be paying $75.
Right.
And it's strong retail.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's strong
we
retail.
We as specialists, we all have these retail guidebooks. The standard rule of thumb in the Scott catalogs, which is what we use for stamp valuations, is we'll take about a third of that number.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
And so, one more question I had.
Sure.
Why does silver and gold go up and down? What's the reason why it goes up? Like
that's
gold
another
up?
Show.
Well, there's part of it is just very simple. It's supply and demand. And if people are looking at the economy and they see gold and silver have traditionally been a hedge against inflation. So if people see inflationary forces coming in, they will hedge their bet by buying some gold or silver. And then you do get speculators who come in and try and corner a market as the Hunts did back in the 1980s. And
didn't
that
they bury
the
all that silver?
Up. They sure did. Yeah, they got buried in it is actually
that's
more
right.
to
that
the
was
point.
Great. That's yeah. a great story.
Oh, fabulous story.
Yeah, that's a book or several books that have already been written.
Yeah.
Israel, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Our number to call here is 800-348-2551. David Tripp at Bob Scott here. It's the Stamp and Coin Show. Let's go to Christy in North Adams.
Hi. I haven't called for a while since I wondered what my black penny would be worth. I have a collection, a child's collection, that probably stopped about 1960.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that I know of that's in there is that's worth anything is the penny, unless you consider the Monaco wedding stamps, but I think there were so many of those.
The famous, yes, the Monaco wedding of
Grace Kelly.
Prince Rainier, which actually have really no value whatsoever because,
that's
as you say, there are so, so many of them. But your penny black, which is probably its proper term, is the first stamp ever issued. And, yes, it does have some value. Is it a used stamp?
It's used, and I haven't looked at it in years. I think the condition could at best be fair. The margins are not even.
Oh, well, that would be the question that I would ask you. The margins, which is basically the white areas around the stamp, if they are large and even, they will add substantially to the value.
That's why it only cost me $5.
Ah. Well, if it cost you $5, it's easily going to be worth $50 now. but the chances are it's not going to be very much. The cancellation, I'm going to assume, is red. A red, say, 3 margin, 1840, Queen Victoria, penny black, about
$50.
$50. Yeah.
How would I package this collection? I don't think I have complete sets of any of the U.S.-denominated stamps.
If the collection was basically put together from 1920 to 1960, you can almost discard anything within that area because the material is just too common. If the stamps are unused, then... one hates to say it, you still have stamps you can use on letters.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
Which yes, is,
but it's the truth.
But it is.
But that's what I've been doing. Okay, that, so I'm not going to bother.
Honestly, keep your penny black and then the rest of them
use them if you can.
Okay. The selling rate for the postage stamps that are unused, add up the face value, and it's going to be about 50-55% of the face value.
Oh, I forgot how depressing this program can get. It's 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. We'll take a quick break, then we'll be back with David Tripp and Bob Scott and your calls.
Support for WAMC comes from Northeast Solar in Hatfield, Massachusetts, helping Pioneer Valley residents live more sustainably with solar power for home, business, or farm. Keep solar local. Northeast-solar.com. Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Over 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more. Harold's.com. The Ashokan Center, announcing Maple Fest. Syrup making, pancakes, crafts, nature walks, and music by Jay and Molly and Story Laurie and Ira. Saturday, March 12th, ashokencenter.org. And Kern Compliance Services, Greenwich, New York, and St. Paul, Minnesota. Compliance consultants to the life insurance industry announcing a symposium in Albany, June 22nd through 24th. KernCompliance.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. I'm Ray Graff, your genial host for the afternoon. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. David Tripp and Bob Scott are here, and we talk coins, we talk stamps. I made a crack at the very beginning of the show about a 1918 inverted Jenny that I put on a postcard to my Aunt Mildred. And I was looking online earlier this week, and I just came across a stamp that had an inverted truck. Were these common to have stamps that had all kinds of inversions on them?
Well, if you go back to the early days, they only printed stamps in one color. It was only in 1869 they first started using two colors. And as soon as they use, so the object was usually in one color, the frame in the other. If it was a plane, if it was a truck, if it was a car, if it was a boat, would always be done in the second color. So the sheets were printed with one color. And then the sheet went back in, they printed the others.
Two-step process, yeah.
As soon as they started using two colors, they started creating inverts.
Okay, so these are not that uncommon.
They are, the earliest ones are incredibly scarce. Incredibly scarce. The rarest one is actually from 1869. It's a 30-cent stamp.
Yeah.
Because the image isn't immediately visible because it's a set of flags draped over eagles. But the Jenny, there was one sheet discovered, just one sheet out of tens, hundreds of thousands of stamps.
Do you think that there are more? I mean, I saw a piece in the news the other day about somebody who was clearing out his grandfather's attic and found 6 Ty Cobb cards.
Oh, the Ty Cobb cards, yeah.
I mean, do you think that there may be a sheet or two lying around somewhere that we don't know about?
The post office was far better regulated in 1918 when the inverted Jenny was found, and there are numerous, numerous apocryphal stories of the second sheet. But the post office inspectors back in those days went through stocks and actually probably did find another sheet or two and destroyed them. They went to the home. I mean, imagine if you went to the post office and bought a sheet of stamps and you found out they were wrong and you went home. the last thing you would expect is to get a knock on your door from a postal inspector saying, excuse me, we think you found some error stamps.
Wow, did they
would
really?
You mind? They yeah. did that to this man, William Robey, in 1918.
So then, in theory, as someone who may be perhaps a tad corrupt, who worked as a postal inspector, might reasonably expect that there'd be some value to these and maybe pop a few aside?
Well, surprisingly, sometime back in the early 1990s, in fact, probably was the late 1980s, a set of Nixon inverts came out.
Really?
When the President Nixon stamp came out, it was, I think, brown on a yellow background. Surprisingly, a group of inverts turned up. And the first few turned up for auction sale. They sold very, very well. But then more and more and more turned up. And surprisingly, they were traced back to the printers.
And
arrests followed. And the thing is, it's federal charges. It's the FBI that comes after you.
Yeah. Okay.
And same thing happens in the coin world. The Mint is notorious for the little interesting things that get created after hours. You may remember a few years ago there was Sacagawea dollars, but they had the reverse of a quarter. And interestingly enough, they were all coming out through the same channels, and it was an employee of the. And he
wow.
went off. And that, in that case, it would be the Secret Service knocking at your door.
Wow, that's really amazing. All right, back to the phones we go. 800-348-2551. Eric in Highland. Eric, you're on.
Well, thank you very much. I have a question about an 1829 Andrew Jackson Peace and Friendship Medal.
Okay.
I just wondered if you could tell me much about it.
Well, when you say peace and friendship, it sounds like an Indian peace medal to me.
Well, it looks like one.
Okay. Is it bronze? Is it silver?
It's sort of penny color, so I assume it's bronze.
Okay. Well, they're different. And just so that everybody knows, when the United States authorities went out and they signed agreements and treaties with Indians and Native Americans around the country.
Before they broke them.
Always before they broke them. One of the traditions, and this goes back to George Washington, is that they would give the chiefs of the tribes a memento of the occasion. Generally, it was a silver medal. In the case of George Washington, with his standing with another Indian, and starting with Jefferson, really, Lewis and Clark took them all across the country, and every time they signed an agreement. So, but what happened is we have the silver ones, which were the ones, and they generally come in three sizes. And the silver ones, which are generally fairly battered, were the ones that were actually presented to the Indians.
Okay.
The Mint then created a series that they would sell to collectors of the period who were always interested. The colors of these are generally a very dark mahogany color. Because they were treated with a special powder when they were made. And
right.
then more recently, in the 20th century, there have been more copies made by the U.S. Mint for sale to the public. The easiest way to tell these is they have a much brighter, almost brassy look, perhaps slightly granular surfaces, and the fields, the blank areas that don't have an image on them, have a tendency to sort of look like a little dome. I mean, they're sort of more convex than concave. And if that's the case, then it's probably a 20th century restrike and worth maybe $50 to $100. If it's one of the darker ones and it has nicely scooped fields, those are very collectible and generally somewhere in the range for the more common ones, $500 to $800, maybe even up to $1,500.
Okay. This one has a diameter of 2.5 inches. Does that shed any light on it?
That's a good size, but they generally made these, that would be the small size actually, which would generally be one of the minor people, that it's not going to make a difference until we see what the surfaces are.
Right, right. Well, the surface, if it were, I'm not sure where excellent, and it's not mint, certainly.
Right, but what I was saying is that sort of what the fabric looks like and whether it's dark, light, and whether it's a 19th century production or a 20th century production,
okay.
and that's
okay,
where your
well,
dollars are.
Well, I guess, could you tell from photographs?
If
or?
You send a photograph, and we'll give the contact at the end, send me an email.
Why don't
with
you give
it,
the it, contact right now?
It's coin, C-O-I-N, and stampguys at
uh-huh.
Berk, B-E-R-K,
okay.
dot com.
And Berk, B-E-R-K.
.com.
And you can send it to voxpop at wamc.org if you want to do it right now, and they can take a look during the show.
Oh, yes.
Well, I'm out welding metal together. So I think
just don't weld the metal.
Yeah, just don't weld the metal to the metal.
Thank you very much, Eric. We appreciate the call. Over to Ari in Applause. You're on.
Hello. I have this dime that I've taken to calling the Liberty Dime.
Right.
And it's nearly worn away. On one side, it has the kind of like postly thing with the, looks like an axe. Then on the other side, there's a woman's face.
Right. It's what we generally call the Mercury Head dime because she has little feathers on her cap.
Yep.
Okay. And these were in production beginning in 1916, and they continued into production into 1945, and then was replaced by the Roosevelt dime that you have in your pocket now. They're wonderfully designed coins. The problem is they have a tendency to lose the date. They get very heavily worn around the date. And the value will be if you can see the date and what the date is.
This is 1919.
1919, okay. And if you can look on the back of the coin where the axe is, which is called a fasces, there might be a little letter, either an S or a D, in the lower left-hand corner.
And that's the mint?
That's the mint, exactly.
So what, San Francisco or
San
Denver?
San Francisco or Denver,
okay.
Precisely.
All right.
Do you see anything there?
No, I can't see anything.
Okay, and it's very, very worn?
Rather worn.
Rather worn. So it's probably going to be worth about $3 or $4, I'm afraid. Okay?
Okay. I may as well keep it.
Absolutely. It's real silver, so it could go up in value just as a mint.
Thank you very much for the call. Our guests today, David Tripp and Bob Scott. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Hello, Belle in Kingston. You're on.
Hi. I found an Emily Dickinson stamp intact. It's white, unused, between linoleum floors of an 1856 Victorian house.
Mm-hmm.
Does it have any value?
Does it have a denomination?
I'm not sure.
Well, is it used?
No, not used at all.
Okay, it's unused, but it should have a number. It should be 8 cent, is it?
Yes, I believe so.
That's right. Wow. Now you know what's coming next.
I mean, it's worth nothing. Use it on your
He can actually see through the microphone.
No, it is actually worth 8 cents. It's a reasonably modern issue. It's an old house, but it's a new stamp.
Well, you got to be sure. I mean, is there a possibility that it's a different denomination and worth some money?
In terms of whatsoever, none.
Okay. All right. Sorry, Belle.
So, yes, no, it's a modern stamp, but pretty design.
Okay. I'll just keep it anyway for memories. Thank you so much.
Exactly. Well, my pleasure.
Well, you guys, you ran on everybody's parade. It's unbelievable.
We don't want to.
All right. Fair enough. All right. Eric in Wendell, Mass. Eric, you're on.
Hey, man. Super show so far.
Thank you.
So
thank
this
you.
Is not exactly a valuation question per
okay.
se, more of a, like a philosophical switching of gears. I want to talk about the penny, the American penny.
Yep.
Is there a more useless coin, like, in the world? And secondly, you know, I find them all the time on the ground. And when I was a kid, you were taught you have to pick them up, right? Every penny you see on the ground, you should pick up.
That's right.
And nobody bought
good luck.
It.
Nobody
right?
bought
There's hundreds of pennies all over the place. So what? I'm going to get off the phone shortly. So my question is, whither the American penny, philosophically speaking? Thanks.
Well, okay, thanks very much. Well, it's a real downer of a program.
Well, there we go. Philosophically speaking, I mean, it's just an indication of inflation, I guess. It costs more than a penny to make a penny. And actually,
2.1 cents to make a penny.
The whole concept, the government very much would like to get away. Certain parts of the government is still making money on most coinage. Because there's something called seniorage. They get, for a quarter, it may cost 5 cents to make it, but it goes on the books at 25 cents, and the difference works toward the national, or against the national debt, toward the profit.
Yeah, okay.
Problem is it doesn't work with nickels and pennies.
Okay.
And it works the other way. So there is a big movement to stop making cents, and because it makes no sense, because they make them in the billions upon billions upon billions.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is also where we get into political issues that there are strong groups of people who want to keep them doing because either they're supplying the metal or the workmanship. It's like people want to get rid of the dollar bill because that's, you know, people argue that that's also similarly wasteful. However, for example, the paper is Crane's, and it's made in Massachusetts. And so there's a political constituency that says, well, we have to keep doing it to keep people in work.
And they have fabulous built-in obsolescence. I mean, the pennies last a long time, but nobody keeps them. They go out of circulation because they go into jars.
Yeah.
The dollar's just – the life expectancy of a dollar is somewhere around 9 or 10 weeks.
Really?
So they have enormous – no, it's three – actually, it goes 3 months, doesn't it?
I think
it's
it does,
12, 13 weeks, but that's it.
Wow.
And so they wear out, and they're constantly being replaced, whereas a coin essentially has no time limit on it.
Well, and it also gives us an idea of how little we think of money. I mean, when we were taught to save, regardless, and I think the problem is we've gotten to such a plastic economy in terms of how people – spend, that unless you actually hold money in your hand, unless you spend cash, whether it's pennies or paper, you really don't have a sense of, almost really don't have a sense of what you're working for in many ways.
That's a very interesting philosophical question.
And, well, he wanted a philosophical answer.
And so if you were to project in the future 10, 20, 30 years, when perhaps the entire economy is
electronic,
then does that render the coins or the paper money or the collectors, will they become more valuable because they're no longer – like it's like Confederate money. I remember in a garage there was a big box of Confederate money.
Right.
And really essentially not worth a whole hell of a lot.
No, because they were created in such vast quantity because there was nothing to back them. It's like when we –
kind of like now.
That's exactly it.
And most
it.
Confederate money was money. Always valueless.
Right.
But the only thing it did was it was held on to people – who had it ingrained into themselves that they should never, ever throw money away. But same thing with German inflationary currency from the 1920s. There's still tons, I mean, literally tons of it around. The same with all the scrip from the Confederates.
But there's the difference. Bob, as Bob said when the lady called earlier about the stamps, you know, a dealer will give you 50 cent face value for a stamp. The United States has never demonetized a coin. Therefore, it's always going to be worth a penny, regardless. So you can always spend a penny. Recently, for example, Lawrence Summers has suggested, because of the trafficking in $100 bills abroad by terrorists, to demonetize $100 bills and demonetize $50 bills and make nothing greater than 20s, which would take trillions of dollars out of circulation.
Mm-hmm. And not without precedent. The Swiss 5,000 franc note, they change them every 10 years.
Right. In England, you can walk in with an old £5 note because you visited there 10 years ago. They've switched for security reasons to a new design. You can't walk into a pub and buy yourself a pint with that particular note.
Well, we've done this here, correct? I mean, there were what, $5,000 bills and things like that.
But no.
We've done it. We've taken them out of circulation.
But if I find one, still worth it.
It's still worth. Oh, yeah. It's worth more.
It's like, actually worth an enormous. I mean, a really pretty $10,000 bill
can over
easily sell for $40,000 or $50,000.
Oh, where can I find one? All right, let's go back to the phones. And Alan in Freehold. Alan, you're on.
Thank you. I've got two kinds of stamps and some are Russian stamps from before the revolution, 1910 or thereabout.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of them are used. And the other, my son was in Azerbaijan and in a market just bought a small stamp album.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the stamps are from the Soviet era, from North Korea, from East Germany, Hungary, etc. I haven't seen those, but I'm on the guess that they're also used. Mm. Any value to either of those?
It really depends on the individual stamps. For the most part, if it's 1940s, 50s, not so much. If it goes back before then, yes, there's a chance. The Eastern Bloc countries really used stamp collecting in the latter part of the 20th century because they would sell them to Western collectors and they would sell them for hard currency. And basically, they just removed any chance of them ever being of any value. But it's just like any other country. It depends on the issues. There are good stamps from the former Soviet Union, from North Korea. There's a few from Cuba, but not very much sort of post-1960. You'd have to consult the book and look at them one for one. Yes, there are a few there, but not so many.
And those from Russia before the revolution, before 1918?
Are most of them just single stamps?
Yeah.
There are a few better, literally just a few better things. Having stamps on envelopes that have actually done something, as in traveled through these eras during these times when the borders were continually changing, there's some real money there. So very easy. Go to the library, find a regular Scots-Russian catalogue. You can look them all up.
Very good. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks a lot for the call. David Tripp is here. Bob Scott is here. Your calls at 800-348-2551. We talk stamps and coins today, and we'll be right back.
Support for WMC comes from Temple Sinai, announcing their annual Community Purim Carnival for all ages Sunday, March 20th, 1 to 3:30 p.m. at Gavin Park, Wilton, New York, 518-584-8730. Quality Foreign Car Care, Boston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years, qfcc.com. Pave Tile Wood and Stone, using French artisan techniques to manufacture pre-finished oak floors, decorative and terracotta tile, and importing aged French limestone, showroom by appointment and online, pavetile.com. The Hyde Collection, an art museum and historic house in Glens Falls, New York, open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, and Sunday, 12 to 5, hydecollection.org. And Interactive Media Consulting, Saratoga Springs, New York, providing logo and print design, web development, and digital marketing throughout the capital region and beyond, marketing creative and business ideas since 1996, imediaconsult.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Number to call is 800-348-2551. We are joined by stamp expert Bob Scott and coin expert David Tripp. And your calls are welcome here and emails as well. VoxPop@WAMC.org. This one's from Jack in Wurtsboro, who writes, I've inherited my grandfather's coin collection. It hasn't been touched since 1963. It's mostly the trifold blue books. Any suggestions where I can have it appraised and sold? That's from Jack.
Well, the first thing you can do is go to the library and get a red book or a blue book. There are key dates for all of these things. Generally, I know from having started this way myself, because I still have my little Whitman fold-out books, I was missing all the rare dates. And if you're missing all the rare dates, you're just up the creek, I'm afraid.
Yeah, don't bother.
So it's always best to start with the library. You can do it online. If it's all Lincoln Head cents, you want 1909S, 1909S VDB, 1914D, etc. But it's always best to start for yourself, and you never know. Even if there's no value there, you may get interested in it yourself.
Okay, and let's go back to the phones. And Sergio in Albany, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Okay, listen, I have a $5 ruble gold coin dated 1901.
Okay.
With the picture of
Nicholas II on one side, yes.
And the then the double eagle with the coat of arms on the reverse.
Right, exactly. Well, these were made in vast, what sort of condition is it in?
It's, from what I can see, I'm not an expert, but all of the detail is very, very clear.
Okay.
It looks like, it's in very good condition.
Okay. Well, they made these. Russia had vast reserves of gold. They made these by the tens of millions, and many of them ended up in central bank vaults and have still been oozing into the market. They have 1.1244 ounces of gold in them. That's the actual gold weight. And so you multiply that by $1,200 or whatever gold is now and add about 25%. And that's what a dealer will pay.
So $100, $150 bucks.
Yep, that's basically it.
Really?
Yep.
That's great news, and I hope that it brought some sunlight into Ray Graff's day, being that it's always been a downer for him so far.
Well, you know, he's smiling. Ear to ear.
Thanks. If I had it, I'd be smiling. Hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate the call. Let's go over to Annie in Ulster County. Annie, you're on.
Hi. I hope everyone is doing well, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling. Part of my question got answered a minute ago. I got a large number of coins when my dad died.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in valuing them, if you don't see the date, then there's really no value. Did I understand that right?
Minimal value, yes. Unless it's a silver coin, if it's a quarter or a dime or a half dollar, there's always the silver value if it was made prior to 1964 or prior. Okay?
Oh, 1964.
Or prior. But if it's a nickel or a cent, no. I mean, their value is really, really limited if you can't see a date.
Okay, and then he also got coins from, like, different countries, and I believe that those countries are using the euro now. He has, like, liras and, you know, other things like that. Do they have any value anymore?
It depends on specifics. The problem with it is, and I must admit I have the same problem because I went traveling around Europe, and I have, you know, 500 lira coins from the 1960s and 70s. The answer is... no, they have no value.
Oh, boy.
You can't take them back, and, you know, you can't take – unless you have them by the ton, the Italians will not take them back. They basically, as I was saying earlier, they have been demonetized by the country, so they literally have no value. And actually in Italy, there's a big – because they've been moving up demonetization dates in Italy to basically bolster the country's economy, and there's a big hue and cry about it in Italy right now because a lot of people are finding that the things – And of course, in Italy, people didn't trust the government, so they put a lot of their values under the mattress, literally.
Right.
And now that stuff has no value whatsoever. So,
Okay. And you had mentioned a book that I could get that might be helpful.
Sure. For American coins, it's the Guidebook to United States Coins, the Red Book or the Blue Book, as we discussed earlier. And if it's for world coins, it's called Krause, K-R-A-U-S-E. And Mishler, M-I-S-H-L-E-R. We call it the phone book because that's how thick it is. And it's the standard catalog of world coins. It's got everything from soup to nuts in there.
All right, wonderful. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thanks a lot. Now, if you wanted to go into a store and buy the blue book, do you have to show your credentials and say, look, I'm a coin dealer?
Absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely.
Really?
No, of course. Yeah. It's to anybody. Actually, the red book is the biggest selling coin book in
history.
That's
the retail. That's the stone cold retail.
And the blue book, they don't have as many out there.
Barnes & Noble will generally have
Barnes
a copy.
And Noble,
okay.
And if you go and if you're going online, Amazon.com,
okay.
Absolutely,
right.
No question, and they update them every year.
So if you were, your uncle Floyd had a bunch of coins and you wanted to value them, would you go for a blue book or a red book?
I would start with the blue book because you know, if you want to know what the stuff is, the red book has more historical information in it.
Right.
The blue book is more a price guide.
And so if you were going, if you said, I'm definitely selling this, you
go
want...
to the blue book.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. And Jim and Rhinebeck. Jim, you're on.
Hi, thanks. I was going to ask a question about baseball cards, but it's just stamps and coins.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty much.
I have a $10 bill from 1934. Is it worth anything besides 10 bucks?
The 1934...
Series of 34, it would be much better if it was a $10,000 bill, which was part of that series in that year.
Yes. But now, it depending on the condition of it...
It's in pretty good condition and no rips or tears or anything.
Okay, but it may have some folds. And is the paper limp or is it crisp?
It's like, you know, wrinkly.
So it's probably going to be worth about $20, $25 or something. There's a little pop-up.
Okay.
There's a little
bump
up on that.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
All right, great show.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you.
All right, over to, I hit the wrong button, so we'll go out of order here. Sean and Kinderhook. Sean, you're on.
Hey, yeah, listen, I had a question about metal detecting. I was reading somewhere they said that there's actually more money in the ground than there is in currency, like circulation. Is this true?
Well, it's entirely possible if you consider all the Roman coins that are in the ground that are all through scattered through Europe, where literally metal detectorists have discovered tons of stuff in one find.
Yeah.
So it's entirely possible. I mean, I don't know the specifics, so I can't tell you, but it would not surprise
That's
me at
interesting.
All.
Except for all those billions of pennies in jars, which probably outnumber
the billions
anything
of pennies
that
in jars,
possibly.
And don't forget the tens of millions of gold coins that are still held by national governments around the world and central bank vaults.
But many of those are underground as well.
They certainly are
Indeed.
Underground.
Sean, thanks for the call. Have you guys had a chance to see the Oak Island mystery on?
I haven't seen it, but I know the story.
It's a great show on the History Channel.
The hole they keep digging, but never figure anything out.
These guys have been at it for so long.
I remember reading about that when I was about 10 years old.
Yeah.
It was just, and it won't go away.
They're high tech, and they still haven't had, there'll be another season. So
good.
Let's go to Mark in Salem. Mark, you're on.
Thank you. I have, it's not a coin for circulation. It is more of a token. When I was restoring my 1790 house, I was carefully removing the wainscoting, the horizontal wainscoting, wide plank, and down behind, lo and behold, I found this coin or this token, and it dated 1863, and it is issued out of Troy, New York. It's about the size of a dime and a little thicker and made out of a brass material.
Right.
And it says redeemable at New York City offices. Now, this is agricultural country up here, and
right.
I was wondering if it was some kind of a token that was given to the farmer when he brought his material into, say, the train. And they gave him that to instead of paying him directly. Are you familiar with
that? Well, tokens of this, yeah, they were sort of quasi, and particularly during the period of the Civil War when coins went out of circulation because
they needed the copper for other things.
They needed the copper for other things. And a lot of these were a combination of being a currency, a local currency, much like we've seen in Great Barrington has now got its own currency.
Berkshires.
And they were also a form of advertising. So it would basically give the name of the merchant. They're called merchant's tokens.
I think it was Miller.
Exactly. And there's a standard catalog for these. And depending on the locality, some of them can have pretty good value. I've seen merchant's tokens sell for as much as $1,500, $2,000, and they can go considerably higher.
But
for the most part, you're probably looking at $4 or $5.
They're fairly researched, but there's still actually a lot of stuff that's not known about.
Oh, very interesting.
It's in pretty good condition because it was down behind those boards for all those years.
Yeah, but there's a standard catalog, again, of tokens.
Tokens, okay.
Yep, and I think it's also Chet Krause, I think, wrote it.
So it's possible, though, that it's not even in the
literature. And if it's
literature.
Not in the book, and some of these only one or two exist, and when I was at Sotheby's, we sold those for $1,500, $2,000 a piece easily and more.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I'll have to go dig it out.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Mark. We appreciate the call. Over to Gary in Poughkeepsie. Gary, you're on.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Hi, how are you?
Good. In response to the caller before calling about the, he wouldn't bother to pick up a penny. It's not worth it.
Right.
Well, my son picked up a penny, and it was a 1793 large cent.
Well, good for him.
Kid.
That's the ding, ding, ding here. We've got a winner.
Yeah,
he did.
That's a Strickland coin.
Actually, he didn't pick it up. He's a big metal detector.
Yeah.
He's been in the treasure hunting magazines a couple times.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, that's the only thing he's ever sold. And he got $6,000 for it.
That's great.
Awesome.
And that's the first year we made pennies in this country. So they are always
the first year the U.S. minted coins, right?
It sure is. Absolutely.
Right.
Spectacular.
And he found a King George. Oh, I forgot what it was now. It was a half coin, though, the other day.
A half a coin?
Yeah.
A half a crown?
It's cut right in half. The King George. That
is a way that, particularly in the Caribbean, they did make change. The expression that we have today, 2 bits is 25 cents, was because they used to cut coins up to make change.
Ah.
And so it was made 8 bits, Which was a dollar, and so 2 bits would be 25 cents, 12 and a half cents to a bit.
And half of that would be a quarter.
Yeah.
Gary, thanks a lot for the call. This one came in via email from Paul, who says, a few years back, I received an unusual penny in my change bin at my store. It was easy to identify as a flying eagle, but it is pretty well worn otherwise. You can clearly, however, read the date as 1856. I know how rare the coin is, but does it have any value in a very worn, circulated condition?
It does have value.
Most of them are worn.
Well, no, 1856 is a special year. It was the first year that the design came in, and it was only a three-year design, 1856, 57, and 58. So it's always been a special date. And even in beat-up condition, and I'm just going to give you a double check here to make sure that I'm not wrong, but...
From large sense to small sense.
It was the first year. It was the first year. Yeah, there we go. But it's the first year of the small sense.
Exactly.
So it's actually very neat. And even a really crummy one if it's 1856. You said that, yes?
Yep.
Okay, well, you're looking probably at $4,000 or $5,000.
Yikes!
Start.
Really? Yep. All right. Well, yep. Paul, cha-ching. Thank you for the email. Let's go back to the phones with David Tripp and Bob Scott and Bill in Arlington. Bill.
Yeah, can you hear me? I'm driving.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a Tim Jennings Bryan. It's a free silver coin. It's enlarged. It shows, you know, from a history perspective where, you know, for the free silver movement. And I don't have it in front of me, but I was just wondering if that's something on your radar.
They're what we call so-called dollars, and because of that, without the specifics, it's hard to know because there were a whole series of these that were made. But... They can have value, and they frequently do have value if they're in decent condition. If you can get us an image, we can help you with that.
All right. What's the email address again?
Coin and Stamp Guys, all spelled out, at Berk, BERK.com.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right, Bill, we appreciate it. Over to Will in Bethlehem. Will, you're on.
Hi. This has been a great show, and you guys have been very patient with the neophyte questions. My great aunt was a postmistress up in Hague on Lake George, and I have a little pile of first day letters with little etchings on the side and some stamps inside in little four squares honoring the Volunteer Firemen of America, Will Rogers, Francis Scott Key, dedication to the Palomar Mountain Observatory,
right.
Uncle Remus Home Magazine. Do these fall in the 1920 to 1960? Use them as... face value, or are they anything?
Yes, they're.
yes.
I mean, can I lie just for a change?
No, don't lie.
Yes, it's the art of diplomacy more than anything else.
Well, you're English. You're good at that.
You can use them without any fear of having recriminations afterwards.
Well, my value here. They're quite. Quite nice. They faded a little bit, but they're nice little etchings on the envelopes.
Yes. I mean, there are wonderful things that you pick up from family members of old postmasters, postmistresses over the years, but they've just got to go back a little bit further.
Okay.
Great. Well, thank you much for your advice. Great show.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much. And over to David in Chester, Vermont. David.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm not a stamper coin collector, but I'm enjoying your show. But I do have a question. An awful lot of what you're talking about, you say it's not really worth anything. Could you share something about the joy of stamp and coin collecting? Why do people do it if none of this stuff is worth it?
Bob and I would both, it's history. It's history. Even Ray, we were talking, it's history in your hand.
Yep.
The $5 million coin we were talking about that went back to George Washington's time. It's the fun. It's the object itself may not have the value per se. In that case, it did. But it's digging back to find out what history was like at the time it was made, who used it, why they used it, what was going on in the country it was made. That's the reason I got into coins. It was more from the historical standpoint and in the enthusiasm. And I think Bob,
and even at the tiniest level, even in pennies, you can deal with Victorian stamps that are 150 years old, things that were handled by soldiers during the Civil War. It's a direct connection to the past. Some of the design facets are brilliant. And just the economic side, the ability in a time when 80% of the population couldn't write, that they could send letters clear across the country for just a few pennies.
David, thank you for that call, and thank you for both of you defending your vocations so well. That was nice. It was a nice way to end the program.
I think so.
Thank you.
And the email address once again?
Coin and Stamp Guys, all spelled out, at Berk, BERK.com.
Well, that was a fun hour.
Thank you.
It was good. It was a fast hour.
We enjoyed it.
A very quick hour, indeed. Support comes from Viva Fresh Pasta, 30 years and 30 wines by the glass, European cuisine infused with flavors of the world, Northampton, Massachusetts. Grab life by the knife and fork. VivaFreshPasta.com. Unusual wedding rings and more. Specializing in wedding and engagement rings and custom-made designs, open Tuesday through Saturday in downtown Pittsfield and Midtown New York by appointment. UnusualWeddingRings.com. Windy Hollow Veterinary Clinic, Montague, Massachusetts, conventional and integrative veterinary medicine, including acupuncture, comprehensive pet care, and health services since 1998, WindyHollowVet.com. And Union College Concert Series, presenting the Eben String Quartet. The Parisian Quartet performs works of Haydn, Debussy, and Beethoven en route to Carnegie Hall, Thursday, March 10th, 7:30 p.m., UnionCollegeConcerts.org. Thanks again to David and Bob for being here. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered by Rose Schneider. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's the Science Forum. Stay tuned now for news.